This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatto. Later in the hour, Cephalopod Week continues. Yes, with a look at camouflage, self-healing, and jet propulsion technologies, all developed with inspiration from squid. But first, in 2015, over 3,500 infants died suddenly and without explanation. Sudden infant death syndrome used to be called crib death. And although the exact causes are unknown, one company in Texas is trying to combat infant mortality by distributing cardboard box cribs. How might these baby boxes help decrease these deaths? Lauren Silverman is here to fill us in on that story. She's the health science and technology reporter at KERA News in Dallas, Texas. Welcome back.
Hey, good to speak with you.
Is this like a regular cardboard box you might use to move your cubicle or furniture?
Pretty much, but without the top, which is important. And in Texas, so the company's based out of California, but they launched in Texas. And in Texas, the boxes that they are handing out to new moms actually have the state flower, the blue bonnet, lined on the inside. So they're a little bit nicer than what you might use to move offices or something like that.
Mm-hmm. And so you have a little clip about what it might sound like?
Yeah. So the boxes, and as you said, are part of this effort to lower infant mortality rate, because one of the main causes babies die is by accidental suffocation. So accidentally smothered by sleeping too close to their parents or soft toys or blankets. So the idea behind the boxes is to remove all those objects and promote safe sleep. So I met one mom, her name is Taylor Freed, to check out what these boxes look like. And this is a clip of her describing them.
Here's your little box. It's got a nice little mattress, a little fitted sheet on it, so it comes with all this stuff inside. And then obviously you take the top off, and then it's a little bassinet. She's about 4 months old, and she can still fit inside of it.
Now, what is the purpose of the box? To keep the baby from moving around, or what?
It's really to promote keeping the baby from sharing a bed with the parents. It's recommended by the American Academy of Pediatrics that babies sleep on their backs in the same room as adults and parents, but not in the bed. So it's a small-ish box. You know, it fits babies up to about 4 months or more. And it is to prevent soft things from getting in the way of them breathing, essentially. And the effectiveness has been shown in a recent study that these boxes do reduce bed sharing if they're paired along with face-to-face education, which is really important that parents are, that they understand why this works and not just putting babies in boxes.
Sounds no good to have a box if you don't know how to use it.
Yes.
Let's move on to your next story, and that is a group of scientists have figured out an interesting way to take a fish census.
Yeah, it sounds a little bit silly, but if you want to figure out how many fish are in the water, is not a really easy way to do roll call. You can't exactly ask fish to raise their hands. But you can ask them to raise their voices, so to speak, and actually sing, because some fish actually have courtship sounds that are almost like songs, although they're not that beautiful. And this could be a way to track how many fish are in a swarm to protect from overfishing. So let's just listen to this one fish, the corvina. Let's listen to the chorus real quick.
Wow, that's one fish.
That might be the one fish, and you can imagine a whole bunch of them. It gets really loud. It's not the most necessarily beautiful thing, but it's really helpful because it's an indication of how many fish there are in a swarm. And so researchers from California and Texas are stuck a microphone essentially in the water and used that to figure out what the health of the population is. And they're going to be using this not just with the corvina, but other fish that like to sing too, cod, sea trout, and grouper.
Well, you know, if I'm a fish, why would I want to give my position away to something that might want to eat me?
Well, I think the researchers say that the corvinas and the other croakers, that's actually the category that they're in, the croakers, generate these sounds to communicate that they're ready to spawn or coordinate information, sort of like a bird call.
That's interesting. Let's move on to researchers mapping out how memory works using math. Tell us about that.
Yes, this is a bit complicated, so prepare yourself. But basically, a group of Swiss researchers from something called the Blue Brain Project have been using mathematical models to simulate the human brain. And what they uncovered are these complicated, multidimensional structures that appear in our brains to process information or to recall memories, and then the structures disintegrate, sort of like sandcastles. And what they're seeing and what they're modeling are, billions and billions of neurons. They're looking at how the neural networks connect. And instead of just being in two dimensions or three dimensions, they found these structures of neural networks that are in shapes up to 7, even 11 dimensions.
Wow, it's hard to imagine that. But I guess if you're a mathematician, that's what you work with.
Yeah, and I read that there's a 10-part documentary that's coming out about the Brain Project, which is great because I think I will need a 10-part documentary to understand
it. I need a visual on this one. Finally, I know this last one sounds like a political joke, but scientists have found a spineless arthropod in a swamp in D.C.
Yeah, I thought it was a joke, too. But then I read more, and it's true. It's this centimeter-long creature. It's spineless, it lacks vision, and it may also eat the remains of its own kind. And it lives in Washington, D.C.
I want to go there so badly, but I won't. But go ahead.
I know. We're not going to go into politics. It's called the Hayes Spring Amphipod, and it's very rare, so rare that it's on the U.S. endangered species list. And the problem is it has been trying to study this little creature without disturbing the habitat it lives in is tricky. It lives in these waterlogged leaves and seepage areas. So instead of sacrificing the little creatures to take them to the lab, researchers are using something called eDNA or environmental DNA. And they sample the water where the creatures had previously been sighted, and they look for the cells that are sloughed off by this tiny, tiny creature to check for it to see if they've been there. It's, just like we leave remnants of ourselves where we sit and move. It's the same idea, eDNA.
Hmm, interesting. We'll be looking for cells all over D.C. Thank you very much, Lauren, for taking time
my
to
pleasure.
Be with us today. Lauren Silverman, health science and technology reporter at KERA News in Dallas. And now it's time to play Good Thing, Bad Thing. Because every story has a flip side. Now it's time for some coffee talk. We're going to talk amongst ourselves. You coffee aficionados know that Ethiopia is the birthplace of the bean, the cradle of coffee. And about 15 million farmers in that country depend on the crop for their livelihood. It appears that, like many things, climate change will likely have a big influence on the future of the coffee crop. Botanists have looked at the effects of climate change on Ethiopian coffee, and the outlook is not good. But there may be ways to save the crop. The results were published this week in the journal Nature Plants. My next guest is an author on that study. He's here to help us break it down. Aaron Davis, Senior Research Leader of Plant Resources at the Kew Royal Botanic Gardens in Richmond, England. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you. Hello.
You call yourself a coffee biologist.
I do, yes.
All right, let's talk coffee. Let's start with the not-so-good news from your study. How much will climate change affect Ethiopian coffee?
Well, we provide quite a range of projections and scenarios. The worst-case scenario is a 60% reduction in the land that's suitable for growing coffee. So that is a really significant reduction.
Yeah.
And that's from now until the end of the century.
Wow, I'm just shocked at hearing 60%.
Yeah, that's the worst case.
That's
really the worst case scenario.
How will the coffee be affected? What happens to the climate that changes that?
Well, it depends on where you are across the world. But for Ethiopia, the real issue is rising temperatures and decreasing rainfall. What we've seen from climate station data is that there has been a steady year-on-year increase, or decade-by-decade increase, in the average temperature in Ethiopia. And in some cases, even from the 1950s onwards, a decrease in rainfall in some of the coffee-growing areas. So the decrease in rainfall and the increase in temperatures make conditions for growing coffee unsuitable in some areas.
Now, you said in some areas, because I understand there is some good news about how the coffee can be grown in a changed climate.
That's right. One of the surprises for us was that actually it's not all bad news. The coffee-growing landscape of the world and Ethiopia is fairly flexible. It changes over time. But what we see, even under the threat of climate change, if you move coffee to the right places, you could actually increase productivity at the end of the century up to 400%.
Hmm.
A massive increase.
And what kind of shifting does that require?
So, there are other scenarios, there are other things that can be done, but it basically means moving, in the main, moving coffee plantations to higher ground where the conditions are cooler.
What about growing more drought-resistant versions of the coffee? Is that possible?
That's also feasible. The real issue is for Ethiopia is that its speciality is Arabica coffee, and that's the coffee that gives us our wonderful flavor profiles. That's the coffee we love. You can replace it with other species. The trouble is they just don't taste the same.
Hmm. I didn't know that Ethiopia was the coffee cradle of the world.
Indeed, it is, yeah. Southern Ethiopia and South Sudan, that's the natural home of Arabica coffee.
Oh, fascinating. Thank you very much, Dr. Davis, for taking time to talk with us today.
You're very welcome.
Aaron Davis, Senior Research Leader of Plant Resources at the Kew Royal Botanic Gardens in Richmond, England. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, Cephalopod Week. Yes, it's here. And if you're a sucker for cool technology, get it? You'll be amazed at what engineers have learned by studying squid. All the things you can make. If you learn how a squid does it, then maybe you can imitate it. So coming up after the break, Cephalopod Week. We'd love to hear from you. Stay with us, 844-724-8255. We'll be right back after this break. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We are continuing our happy Cephalopod Week. As you might know, every June we celebrate the wonder of cephalopods, from the spooky vampire squid to the camouflaging cuttlefish and the octopus nicknamed Adorabilis, which might just be our mascot. It's such a cute little thing. You got to go see it on our website. And all week we've been getting squiddy with it, gathering geeks at events around the country. And let me tell you, the excitement at these events, like this one in New York, whoa, it was palpable. It was. Where else would you hear a chant like that? Well, the Cephalobration continues today, and we've got our master of cephalopod ceremonies here, Brandon Echter, to catch us up on all the action this week. Welcome back, Brandon.
Hey, Ira. Happy Cephalopod Week.
Thank you. You too.
So much happened this week. We learned a ridiculous amount of new cephalopod facts. At least I did, and I hope everyone else did too. So not only did we have those amazing events throughout the country, with Atlas Obscura in New York, in San Francisco, in Chicago, in Los Angeles, we also had institutions from around the country sharing stuff as well. Places like the Field Museum and the Greater Cleveland Aquarium, the American Museum of Natural History did probably the most soothing thing in the world by vacuuming their giant squid and the whale diorama that hangs in the hall there. It's and actually created a video that gave a background of that battle, which was really fascinating. Vancouver Aquarium, stuff like that. But we also heard from places like Gizmodo and Popular Science and the New York Times. The Times was on it. And, we were able to pull together some really fascinating facts about cephalopods that I didn't even know this week. So, for example, there's this one genus of octopus called the blanket octopus.
Mm-hmm.
So the females of this species, when they're threatened, they open their arms and release this giant, like almost like Superman cape. It's huge, and it's been fascinating looking. And these species, the females are actually 10,000 times larger than the male.
Wow.
The females can be like up to 6.5 feet long, and the males are just little
wow,
tiny guys. But interestingly enough, this is one of the few genuses that are immune to the sting of a Portuguese man-of-war. So juveniles of, this, of the genus are known to go up to Portuguese man-of-war and steal the stinging tentacles and use them as weapons to defend themselves. I know, right? Yeah. They're really superheroes. It's very a very superhero origin story there. And then the blue-ringed octopus, which is the most venomous species to humans, they actually, the males of the species actually can't really tell the difference between males and females. So they have this scattershot mating strategy where they mate with both. And it's just, you know, we learned all sorts of really fascinating stuff.
And we have a great video up on our Facebook page.
Yeah, absolutely. So KQED Sciences Series Deep Look actually produced this amazing video about squid skin and how they use their skin to hide in plain sight, essentially. So, you know, squid have these, you know, sacs in their skin, chromatophores and iridophores, that kind of hide them in plain sight, which is just, it was just fascinating to see. And, you know, as the title of the video is, you're not hallucinating, it's just squid skin. And it definitely, it makes you feel very, it blows your mind.
All right, well, hang around. We're going to come back and talk to Brandon later.
I'll see you in a bit, Ira.
We'll see you a little bit later. But right now, we're going to talk more about these camouflage abilities because the theme of the rest of the hour is how there's a lot of awesome technology inspired by cephalopods, what we like to call applied cephalopod science. And up first, a scientist who's learning from the camouflaging ability of these animals to design better camouflars for humans. Elon Gardetsky is an assistant professor of chemical engineering and material science at UC Irvine. He joins us today from KUCI. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, Ira. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. So what's so special about what cephalopods can do in terms of camouflage? Give us a taste of some of their abilities.
It's really remarkable. I mean, some of the videos that you can see of what they accomplish in the wild, you know, they can basically change color and texture and shape in some way. You know, really, it's the equivalent of me sitting here and then backing onto a wall and turning into a file cabinet, maybe without even ever having seen a file cabinet. It's just that amazing in the ocean.
Well, so how does it actually work? I mean, you say that it changes its color and its texture also. What's going on sort of, let's drill down into a cellular level. What's going on the cephalopod there?
So their skin functions like a really advanced bioelectronic display. So you have multiple types of cells embedded within these transparent dermal and epidermal layers. And these cells are called iridophores, chromatophores, and leucophores. This is very general for most cephalopods. And each of those cells performs a different function. So some will reflect white light, diffuse white light. Some will change area and size and filter the light that goes through the skin, and some will shift the color that's reflected back. And together, you know, they can perform some really amazing feats. I think you guys have some videos.
Yeah,
of that
we
stuff
have.
On,
we
on
have
your
incredible
website.
Over the years we've been doing Cephalopod Week. We've had incredible videos of shape shifting cephalopods. So now let's talk about you as an engineer. How do you adapt what we know about cephalopod camouflage cells to your own work? How do you apply these principles?
So we specifically focus on proteins that are found in all three of these cell types. And we use these proteins as materials and try to understand them because they're found in larger structures within the cells where those structures are what enable some of the color-changing abilities for cephalopods. And we make very, very simple systems from these proteins, and we learn from them. And then we try to translate these systems into something more sophisticated. So an example of one type of structure found in these cells is you have multiple layers of a protein that alternate with other materials, essentially. And you can change the thickness and some of the properties of these layers to change the color of the cell. You know, in some ways, it's analogous to kind of the stack that you would have in a Big Mac, where you have alternating layers of bread and meat. But, you know, imagine if your Big Mac could change color, texture, you know, and taste on the fly as you're eating it. That to me it would be no less remarkable to what these types of cells.
So it's a many layered thing that's going on there in
yes.
the skin, and you can adjust
for one specific cell.
Yeah.
Yes.
Wow. Is it? It's almost sounds to me like there's sort of a computer screen change going on. You know, it's different. Different things make the different colors, make the different shapes, I guess.
Yes, and it's I think it's even more advanced than what we can really do artificially in terms of computer screens.
Yeah.
So we try to learn from those systems, and then make something that's essentially completely artificial and that captures some of the key properties of mm-hmm. these types of structures. So you would be able to have a wearable technology that can do some of the same adaptive or real-time color changing tricks.
You mean like camouflage for a uniform or a tank or something like that?
That would be one of the potential applications. And not just in the visible, because that's where the animals focus. We're also trying to do this in the infrared, so to allow objects to conceal themselves in different regions of the electromagnetic spectrum.
Wow! So you sort of hide behind it.
That would be the goal. Yes.
And so, how close are we to seeing something practical?
We have some exciting things in the lab. So I think we're only a few years off. You know, 2 or 3 years. From really practical, useful materials that you might even be able to wear.
Wow.
Based on the things we've learned.
Wow. Well, great new clothing. Thank you, Dr. Gardeski, for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you so much, Ira. It's really my pleasure. I could be one of the people yelling about Cephalopod Week, as you mentioned.
They are fascinating. I mean, they're just amazing. Thank you for taking time to be, as I say, for taking time to be with us today. Melek Dara... Alan Gardeski, who is talking about creating clothing and things. He's assistant professor of chemical engineering and material science at the University of California at Irvine. We're going to also now switch gears and talk out, what if you could heal a rip or a tear in your genes? You know, what if Alan's stuff maybe hides your genes? What if you could repair your genes simply by throwing your pants in the dryer? You press the edges of the rip together. They stick together, right? We bring you the story of a self-healing material inspired by squid suckers. With my guest, Melek Demirel. He is director of Center for Research at Advanced Fiber Technologies, professor of engineering at Penn State University, University Park. Welcome, Dr. Demirel, to our show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Now, let's talk about self-healing properties here. Your research on that material, started with a fishing trip? Is that right?
That's correct. So we were looking for specific proteins. And in the last 5 years, we were interested in the squid, specifically the suction cups. There is a protein that is very similar to your nail and hair. So we were interested in this protein and its sequences and its properties. So there are around 350 different squid species around the world, and we went around the world and collected several of them together with my students and collaborators. We went to Mediterranean, Atlantic. A collaborator of mine went to Hawaii and Argentina and so on. So we collected several samples.
So you brought back these squid, and they have something unique, some unusual protein in their suction cups?
Yeah, the protein was known, but what we were interested in is how we can engineer this protein so that we can make a new material out of this. The material that is inside the suction cup is called squid ring teeth protein. Basically, it has an ability to self-heal, self-repair itself.
How do they work? You just stick the proteins together and they just attach to one another?
Yeah, we dissolve the protein in different solvents and you apply it to conventional textile. It could be cotton, wool, polyester, any of them. basically a garment or a cloth that you have, your T-shirt. And then you can rip the clothes and you apply heat and, you know, barely body temperature and then minimal pressure, which it will then start to heal. It's very much like a glue, but a glue that works at the molecular scale through the self repair, self assembly.
When I think of long, skinny proteins and I think of glue, I'm thinking like pasta sticking together when you cook it. Is it something like that?
Yeah, it is basically, you can think about like that. Basically, you know, these are long protein sequences that can self-assemble very much like the pasta. You take the pasta and there's individual pasta and then you start cooking it. When you dry it, it's almost impossible to take individual chains out of it. So basically, it is a, you know, it's already entangled to each other. In the molecular case, this proteins, you know, entangled differently by using hydrogen bonds and so on. But it's that example represents, you know, a similar similarity.
This is Science Friday from PRI Public Radio International, talking about the Cephalopod Week with Melek Demirel, who is talking about self-healing garments. Do we have a garment yet, Dr. Demirel?
Yes, we made several examples of garments, and you know, we tested them for applications in, you know, in different areas. One of them is to defense against chemical and biological threats. The other example was we made a coating for medical applications. Hernia is one of the major problems in clinical surgery, and we applied our coating for hernia repair, and we have seen good results in animals.
Well, could you possibly heal wounds with it, this kind of idea?
Possibly. It could be extended to a biodegradable gel for wound healing in the near future.
Do you think that nature, you know, has thought of just about everything, that all we need to do is find, you know, an application that we could use?
So what we observed in this case was the self-healing property. And I always had this question in my mind. What are the other proteins that can give us different properties that we don't know? So, you know, can we take the nature's evolution and put it into lab and accelerate it? So now we are working on a new tool that can basically squeeze the billion years of evolution of proteins to ours. This is a technique that we are developing and moving forward with that.
Why would cephalopods need this self-healing ability?
We don't know exactly what is the mechanism of self-healing, but as you know, the suction cups help to grasp the prey. So, you know, the fight between the prey and the squid, you know, caused deformation and fracture into these proteins. Remember, cephalopods, especially the squid, is an invertebrate. It does not have any bones. So these proteins, nail-like proteins, are very strong. And they deform, they crack. And basically, we believe that this self-healing mechanism is helping to repair these nails or these protein structures.
Mm-hmm. So an cephalopod might lose an arm and then, repair itself.
Not necessarily the arm, but the inside the suction cup, these these proteins specifically bite to the to the fish that it's attacking, so it can help after the fight is over, it can help to repair. But we don't exactly know the mechanism, how it works in nature, because what we are doing is applying temperature. And generally, nature doesn't use temperature. It's probably using some other chemical mechanism, but we don't know that yet.
You'd like to know that, I'll bet.
Sure.
Yeah. That'll be the next study. Thank you very much for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Dr. Melek Demirel is director of the Center for Research on Advanced Fiber Technology and professor of engineering at Penn State University. We're going to take a break, but the Cephalo Party is not over. It's going to continue through the break, and we're going to look at another technology that scientists are looking at in cephalopods' repertoire, and this is the underwater jet set, squid. Squids get around with little water jets Maybe we could too. We'll find out how that works. Stay with us. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. You know, we talk with a lot of scientists from NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory about all that neat stuff they shoot into space. But I wanted to bring on a guest today who works at a different sort of jet propulsion laboratory, one where the jets are not space-bound but underwater instead. Diana Lee is a PhD candidate at Stanford's Hopkins Marine Station in Pacific Grove, California. She studies how squid move, and she joins us by Skype today. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, Ira. It's great to be here.
You're welcome. We're also joined by one of Diana's collaborators, Kakani Khatija, who's principal engineer at the Monterey Bay Aquarium Research Institute in Moss Landing, California. Welcome back to Science Friday, Dr. Khatija.
Oh, thank you so much. It's great to be able to talk with you.
Well, you're very happy to have you. Let me ask you, Diana, fishing trips are a common theme on the show today. So you were just out on a fishing trip on your earlier this week? Did you catch anything what you were looking for?
Yeah. So we went out last Friday and we caught 4 squid right off of Hopkins Marine Station in Monterey Bay. And actually, I'm seeing the bay right now from a window in the room I'm sitting in. So we go out to look for California market squid. They are about, 9 or 10 inches in size. If you order calamari and they serve you fried rings at the restaurant, it's probably what you're eating. So that was the animal we're looking for, and we found a couple.
Now, I know you didn't get it to fry it up there. You were going to study other things.
Yeah, so we caught them for experiments. And one of the things I'm very interested in is how they swim. And I find squid to be very interesting and unique in the way that they swim because they combine 2 different strategies. They use fin activity, so they can wave or undulate or flap the fins that you see on one side of their body. But what they're most famous for that you were alluding to is jet propulsion. So I like to think of squid as little nature's underwater rockets jet propelling around in the ocean.
Mm-hmm. Now, Kakani, from an engineering standpoint, is this impressive or unusual what squid do?
It is quite impressive, and one of the projects that I know Diana's been working on lately is looking at, what the small, the baby squid, the squid paralarvae are actually able to do. And so there's reports of the small paralarvae actually able to swim about 50 body lengths per second. And to put that into context, we can think of someone like Usain Bolt, one of the most amazing sprinters that we know. And he is clocked at running about 5 to 6 body lengths per second. And so imagine Usain Bolt having to run about, 10 times faster. But because of the size of these animals, the paralarvae, are about 1 millimeter to 2 millimeters in size. It would mean Usain Bolt would have to run about 10 times faster, but in honey, to be able to experience the kind of fluid regimes that these small animals live in.
How are they able to do that? What's the secret?
Great question.
What's the secret that they have that they can just, zip around? Well, that's an amazing speed through the water. Kakani, what can you as an engineer learn from this?
Well, so that's a great question, and I know Diana's been looking a little bit more at the musculature and also the mechanisms that allow for these rapid, jet-propelled motions. And in terms of engineering, there's a lot of different applications for that. For instance, if we're interested in, trying to move fluid or, affect or control the temperature, let's say, of electronics as they become smaller and smaller, you can imagine a micro mixer that's similar to, the jet-propelled fluid that these small squid paralarvae are actually able to achieve. That could be a potential application. Mm-hmm. There's many others as well.
I'll bet. Diana, you think you're going to figure this out? How the squid can move this fast?
I hope to figure out just a very small part of it. But what we already know is the secret sauce to how they can produce these huge accelerations and move so quickly is in the nerves of the animal. So even in the very tiny baby squid, the size of a grain of rice, we think that the strategy is similar to what adults have. So they have these huge, huge, huge nerves, the giant axon, it's called. And when you have an axon that's super big, it's really easy to conduct electrical signal down this axon because there's less resistance. So because signal can travel super fast along the whole body, they have that whole mantle, that long mantle that contracts to make these jets, so they can produce really strong muscle contractions at a couple milliseconds notice. So I think that's part of how they can make these impressively fast jets. But I hope to find out more about how they're interacting with the fluid, especially these small animals that Kakane was saying that to them, the water feels less like water and more like honey. So they have a very different life that they experience at that size. And we're hoping to understand more by imaging how the fluid is moving around these animals as they swim through the water.
Do other marine animals share these giant nerves? You know, I'm thinking of Eric Kandel, who made a career and got a Nobel Prize out of studying the sea slug for the giant nerves they had.
Yeah, there are other marine animals that have what are termed like these giant axons. They're not exactly the same, but they're functionally similar. We have, you know, the crayfish definitely has it for the powerful tail flip. There are analogs in other vertebrates like fish with their like M cells. So these types of nerves exist across many animals, and it seems like these animals have solved similar problems using similar strategies, though not exactly the same.
Mm-hmm. It would be pretty hard, Kakane, I imagine, trying to imitate this. What would you use as an analog of a giant nerve?
Oh, that's a great question. I think one of the biggest challenges, you know, about bio-inspired design, and that's part of the reasons why, you know, studying squid, not only jet propulsion, but also, you know, their fin activity, is kind of a holy grail of underwater vehicle design, right? How do you replicate these kinds of motions with these soft materials that have such high efficiencies when it comes to swimming?
Hmm. Well, we'll wait to see what you come up with. Very eager to have you back on when you learn more about it. I want to thank you both for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you so much.
Kakane Khatija is principal engineer at the Monterey Bay Aquarium Research Institute in Moss Landing, and Diana Lee is a PhD candidate at Stanford Hopkins Marine Station in Pacific Grove, California. Before we say goodbye, in the remaining minutes of our hour, we want to bring back our Master of Cephalopod Ceremonies, Brandon Echter, and a digital managing editor at SciFry. Welcome back, Brandon.
Hey, Ira.
And we're also joined by another Ceph head on the SciFry staff, Lauren Young, our web producer. Hey, Lauren.
Hey, Ira. How's it doing? How are you doing?
I know you wrote a wonderful literary piece on our website for Cephalopod Week, a story about the tale of the author John Steinbeck and the little mystery of the Humboldt squid. The mystery. What's the mystery there?
Yeah. Who would have thought that John Steinbeck was in any way related to the Humboldt squid? In 1940, in March, he went on an expedition from Monterey in California, and he left with a marine biologist and a close friend of his, Ed Ricketts, to the Gulf of California, also known as the Sea of Cortez. And they explored the area and recorded marine wildlife in the area and documented a bunch of different species. And the expedition ended up resulting in a couple books, The Log of Sea of Cortez, and also Ed Ricketts ended up becoming kind of an inspiration for the character Doc in Cannery Row. And then later in 2004, it ended up becoming kind of an inspiration for a lot of different other biologists and writers. And some people ended up deciding to retrace the steps.
And so what was the mystery that they were trying to solve?
Right. So it ended up, when they went back in 2004, they tried to see what the changes were in the Gulf. And they ended up finding an unpredictable predator there, the Humboldt squid, which was interesting to the biologists because Ricketts and Steinbeck did not see any Humboldt squid at all. They saw some other squid, but it was definitely not the Humboldt squid. So that's what the biologists were basically puzzled by, trying to figure out why they are here now.
Did they figure it out? Did something change in the squid, or did something change in where they were living?
Right. So there are a lot of there's some interesting hypotheses, which you can read about in the article, but they vary from climate change and differences in water temperature in the Gulf, as well as differences in fish population because of overfishing in the area as well. So there's a lot of different juggling hypotheses and trying to figure out the life history of the fish, of the Humboldt squid in the Gulf. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a great article. And Brandon, what's going on around the country and Bring us up to date. Are we going to still continue with our Cephalo Party?
Yeah. So even though today is the last day of Cephalopod Week, the Cephalo Party does not need to end. So one of the really cool things about Cephalopod Week this week is that a lot of aquariums and institutions all around the world were participating. Like we saw research institutions from places as varied from the United States and Canada to France and Israel to, you know, aquariums like the Monterey Bay Aquarium and the South Carolina Aquarium doing octopus encounters live on video on Facebook and on Periscope. And we also had our like live events where we had like undersea marionette puppet shows and actual octopuses in the studio with them. And just because we're ending here doesn't mean that you can't do stuff at home. So we have a ton of our education team has been working hard to create a ton of really amazing cephalopod resources for us. So, and I actually have something for us to play with here, Ira.
Oh,
so,
love that stuff.
So, look at this. So, I've got two beaks here. This is actually the beaks from the Humboldt squid, and I'm going to give one to you real quick. And you can actually learn a lot about these from these beaks.
That just is big.
Yeah, they're big. But did you know that you can actually, using math, calculate based on the size of this beak how big the Humboldt squid it came from actually is? So
it would have to be a big squid.
Oh,
for
yeah,
this.
Yeah, yeah. No,
let me just describe for our listeners. It looks like a giant parrot beak. It's just a part of the beak. But it is, I'm going to say, a good 2 inches across.
Yeah, it's
across.
Like, I was going to say, it's like a little smaller, maybe a little smaller than a baseball right now.
Yeah.
But it's, you know, it's huge. But you can actually, using this beak, you know, figure this out. So there's been a ton of research of this over the years. And there's this one formula that was in particular that was found by researchers at Texas A&M University, where if you measure the rostral length, the lower rostral length of the jaw, you can figure out the mantle length. So the lower rostral length is this like flat part right here, and on this small one here, let's if we measure it out, it is.
While you do that, let me remind everybody that this is Science Friday from PRI Public Radio International. Here with go ahead.
Here with some math. So this one and this particular beak, this one that I have, which is much smaller, it's maybe about the size of a golf ball, is 1.3 centimeters. Now, using this formula, and I'm not going to read it all out because it's a very long. It's got a lot of long numbers in it. We can figure out that this the Humboldt squid this came from. Actually, it's the length of its mantle is 0.509 meters, which is about 1.5 feet, maybe a little bit more than that. And for that one over there,
this must be huge.
Oh my God! So let's measure it out.
You're gonna measure that?
So we're measuring it out, and that's about 3 centimeters. And using that same technique, that is 1.11 meters, and that is about 3.66 feet. So
3.5 feet.
3.5 feet
for a. Wow.
Yeah, and you don't need to and you can use this to figure out the body mass of a cephalopod and stuff like that. So, don't worry if you don't have access to squid beaks. Ariel Zitch, our education director, did a great job of 3D scanning one of the beaks, so you can actually play with them on our website sciencefriday.com/cephalopodweek. You can see that and all of our stuff there. And you'll be able to like play around with it, move it in a 3D space, and if you have access to like an institution or a professional 3D printer, you probably can't do it at home. You'll be able to print one out yourself.
You can take that little. I saw it up on our website there. It's incredible. You can rotate the beak around, and you say that if you have a good 3D printer, you could run that photo through it.
Yeah,
it'll print out.
If you have a good one. We actually went to worked with some folks at NYU to get these scanned. But I would actually suggest going to your local research institution or a library or somewhere that has a really high quality printer rather than using your home one. And it's not just that. Earlier this week, you may have noticed our office smelled a little. This morning, when you came in, you may have noticed our office smelled a little squiddy.
Squiddy, yes.
That's because yesterday we were making squid prints, which is another way you can actually learn about squid anatomy. So we're literally putting paint on squid and seeing the prints they pulled out and creating some really beautiful, if a little smelly, pieces of art. So you can use that to take a look at, basically do an outdoor, like an anatomy lesson of squids. And you can find this and other stuff about, including creating your own jet-setting cephalopod on our Educate page and at sciencefriday.com/cephalopodweek.
And we had all those great events around the country.
Oh,
this week,
yeah.
Right? We heard some of the cheering that went on here in New York.
Oh, yeah. And I think in each of these events, we actually had experts from various institutions. One of the experts, Sarah McNulty, who studies the Hawaiian bobtail squid, kind of was talking about working with cephalopods in general, and has said that octopuses have personalities, cuttlefish have personalities, squids may not have personalities, and octopuses actually are really good at using their siphon to hit you in the face with water. So there were events all over the country. But they are smart,
those octopuses.
Oh, man, they're so smart. And, you know, it's great to see them in video, and it's great to see them in, unfortunately, dead ones. But, you know, you should actually go to your local aquarium and see them live, because they're amazing to behold in life.
And you may get to handle one.
Exactly.
Handle one.
Maybe. You may have to get in on that.
They're not great pets. You can't really keep them at home.
No,
it's
they're not.
It's hard to keep making a reef aquarium for them.
Yeah,
like absolutely.
And you might not be able to handle one, no. But you may be able to see a Aquarius handle them, or a cephalopod wrangler.
So shout out to all those aquaria across the country.
Absolutely.
Get ready for the invasion of the cephalopod geeks.
They're coming. They're coming for you.
All right. Thank you very much, Brandon Hector, our resident cephalopod party starter. Also, in charge of Cephalopod Week. Thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you, Ira.
A quick day, but before we go, you can check out everything on our website at sciencefriday.com/cephalopodweek. One last thing, I'm wishing a well-deserved retirement to Manoli Weatherall, long-term NPR sound engineer and emeritus member of our Sci-Fry family. She'll be retiring real soon now. Best wishes to Manoli, and happy to call you a friend and a colleague for 35 years. Charles Berkowitz is our director, our senior producer, Christopher Taliata. Our producers are Alexa Lim, Christy Taylor, and Katie Heiler. Rich Kim, our technical director, Sarah Fishman and Jack Horowitz. Our engineers at the controls here at the studios of our production partners, the City University of New York. Have a great Cephalopod weekend. I'm Ira Flato in New York.